Imagine that you've been accused of murder. Almost a year ago, a man was shot and killed in his home, and a woman who was there when it happened says that she saw you do it. That she saw you and two of your friends come into her house and rob her and her boyfriend. And then, just as the three of you were leaving, one of your friends turns around and shoots her boyfriend. The three of you leave the house and she calls the police, but it's too late. Her boyfriend dies. She tells the police that you did it. This witness has no reason to lie, and there's no reason whatsoever, really, to doubt the basic outline of her story. And at least in this case, there's no chance that she's the killer or anything like that. She's the eyewitness to the case, and she says you did it. She's also the only eyewitness at your trial. Actually, she's the only evidence against you, period. There's no other corroborating evidence, no forensics, nothing like that. But then, why should there be? It was a simple, senseless crime, and the evidence against you is just as simple. She saw you do it. She's certain of it. She was right there. You did it. Case closed. End of story. As the prosecutor will tell the jury at your trial, ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you that what you are about to hear is virtually a perfect case. You had an eyewitness who knew and loved the defendant, who had a ringside seat, who knew each of these co-defendants and told the police immediately what happened. Now, this case against you, although virtually perfect, still takes a while to solve. But that's only because the police didn't have your real name yet. The eyewitness knows you. She's seen you before, maybe a couple times. But she's only ever heard you called by a nickname. So the police have to go out and connect a nickname to a photo that they can put in a photo array so that she can tell them for sure who you are. And that takes some time. But other than that, it's such a strong case that there's barely any need for police work at all. As the prosecutor will remind the jury that decides your fate, this is not a whodunit. You have the eyewitness coming in saying she knows these three guys. All the detectives have to do to solve this case is to put a real name on a nickname and go and lock these guys up. So all this has happened, this is what you're up against, but you didn't do it. You weren't there, you weren't involved in the murder, and you have no idea how it is that you got brought up in this at all. You don't know why the eyewitness is doing this, why she's saying you did it. You don't know if she's lying or just wrong or what, but she is wrong. How exactly, though, are you supposed to prove that? In a case with no evidence beyond the word of someone with no reason to lie, how do you prove you didn't do it? Sure, you can poke holes at her story, maybe attack her character, bring up her drug use. Your attorneys can do all that. But what does that really get you? As Terrence Lewis found out in 1999, it doesn't get you anywhere at all. On the basis of that one eyewitness with no reason to lie, he was convicted of a murder that happened when he was 17 years old, and given a life sentence, he is still serving today.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Terrence Lewis. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson, I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2, and I also podcast along with Rabia at The 45th.
Hi, this is Colin Miller, I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
It was a sticky, hot August night in the summer of 1996, just after 11 p.m., when the police got a call to report a shooting. The address was for a little row house out on the western edge of Philadelphia on Sansom Street, and within minutes, officers Frank Hack, Sean Butts, and Mariano Medella arrived on the scene. They arrived to find a woman at the front of the house. She's frantic and screaming, yelling, "He's been hurt, he's back in the kitchen." The officers cautiously move through the narrow row house, and three rooms back, they find a man laid out on his back. He was, in the words of the report they will later write, obviously dead. There's a gunshot wound in his stomach, and when they roll him over, they find an exit wound on his back. 57-year-old Yulon Bernard Howard has been murdered. He is the 247th person to be murdered in Philadelphia that year, and so far that summer, just in his neighborhood of Cobbs Creek alone, on the very western edge of Philadelphia, five other men have been shot and killed. The day after Bernard's death, another man will be shot and killed in a barbershop just three blocks over. By the time the cops got to the house on Sansom Street, the only witness still around is the woman who called 911 and who met the cops at the front door, 37-year-old Lena Laws, though she tells the police she usually goes by the name Star. She's the victim's girlfriend. She's distraught, but she's willing to be interviewed. She speaks fast, though, and has some kind of speech impediment. Sometimes it's not clear if the officers understood everything she was saying.
But Star is clear on the most important fact, and that's who killed her boyfriend. The shooter, she tells them, was a man who went by Mello. He'd come over to their house with two other guys. Bernard talked to the three in the front of the house for a bit, but then they all came back to the kitchen where Star was, along with two of Bernard's friends who were visiting at the time. The men who'd come to the door were young, late teens or early 20s, and they were armed. One of them fired a sawed-off shotgun into the ceiling, and another went around turning out the pockets of everyone in the house, robbing them. And then, when it was over, the one called Mello shot Bernard, and all three of the men ran out of the row house. Star told the officers that Mello lived just a block away, on Walnut Street, and that his real name might be Jamal. And then she got out a piece of paper, wrote down a 7-digit number with the name Mello beside it, and gave it to Officer Butts. That's the number for the guy that shot Bernard, Star told him. She called it once as a favor for Bernard, and got a voice message. That's why she thought Mello might be Jamal, because there had been some kind of Muslim greeting, and then the voice said, "This is Jamal, please leave a message after the beep." The three officers at the scene also wrote down a brief description of the three men. They were youngish, 19 to 21 years of age, thin builds, bald heads. Mello had a darker complexion, while the other two were lighter skinned. At that time, though, still at the house that night, the only name Star tells officers Hack, Butts, and Medella is Mello. According to one officer, Officer Butts, Star tells them that Mello had a Tech 9 that he used to kill Bernard, and one of the other two males had a shotgun that he fired into the kitchen ceiling. Another officer, though, Officer Medella, hears differently. Medella thought that Star told him that Mello had the shotgun, and a shotgun was the only kind of weapon the three young men had. It was Mello, Star says, that fired into the ceiling with a shotgun, and it was Mello that shot Bernard with a shotgun. Or at least, that's what Medella remembers Star saying. Maybe he just misheard. Maybe Butts had it right. Maybe what Star told them was the way he remembered it, that there were two guns, a Tech 9 and a shotgun, and it was Mello with the Tech 9 who killed Bernard.
But although the police reports and interviews from officers Hack, Butts, and Medella don't mention it, there's one thing I definitely wonder. Whether Star told the police it was Mello or one of the other men that fired the shotgun, all the officers agree on one thing. She did say that someone had fired a shotgun into the ceiling. And even though the police didn't do an extensive job in processing the crime scene, you don't really need forensics evidence to see the problem here with Star's story. Because a shotgun blast into the ceiling would leave a mark, and there wasn't one. No bullet holes in the kitchen ceiling or anywhere else in the house. No sign that the shotgun had been pointed up and fired, like she says. But if the police noticed this discrepancy at the time, their reports don't record it anywhere. And not long after that, EMTs arrived at the scene and declared Bernard dead. And at about 12:20 a.m., maybe an hour after the murder happened, another officer, Officer Taggart, will pick Star up and take her down to the police station for a longer interview.
Casper is a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. It's designed by humans for humans, and at Casper, mattresses are perfectly designed and engineered to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. Because you know what? We spend one third of our lives sleeping, and we gotta be comfortable. Casper mattresses provide all the support the human body needs in all the right places. They've got three fantastic models to choose from. They've got the original Casper, the Wave, and the Essential. And it's not just a mattress company. They offer a wide array of products to ensure, like, overall better sleep experience. And believe me, I'm somebody who is chronically sleep deprived. So Casper and their products have done a lot to transform my sleep experience and giving me the rest that I need. And Casper's incredibly convenient. They have affordable prices because they cut out the middleman and they sell directly to the consumer. They have no hassle returns if you're not completely satisfied, and they deliver the mattress right to your door in a small, how do they do that, size box. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. And there's free shipping and returns in all of Canada and the United States. Now you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on it trial. Think about that. You get 100 nights to sleep on your Casper mattress before you decide whether or not you want to keep it. I got my Casper mattress a couple of years ago, and I am basically never going to look back. I'm never going back to the kind of mattresses that I've slept on my whole life with the springs and all that. I'm getting the best night's sleep of my life. So start sleeping ahead of the curve with Casper and get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/undisclosed and using undisclosed at checkout. It's also a great time to make Casper a gift for somebody you love and somebody who really needs a good night's sleep. So once again, check out this great promotion. It's casper.com/undisclosed and use the promo code undisclosed to get $50 off any mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply.
A couple hours later, Detective James Hughes interviews Starr down at the Homicide Division. But the Philadelphia police didn't record interviews then, and all we've got to go on to know what she said in this interview are the notes that Detective Hughes took. 7 handwritten pages of scribbled cursive, laying out questions that Detective Hughes asked her, and Starr's answers to them. This time, in this interview, sitting down in the station, she gives more details than what Officers Hack, Butts, and Mandela recorded, maybe because of the calmer environment there as opposed to back at the row house. She had been home all night, Starr tells him. Bernard had gone out, though, and about 10:30 p.m., he came home, and he brought two friends of his with him, Omar and Denise. Starr hadn't liked that, not the part about him bringing Denise home with him anyway. She tells Detective Hughes that she'd gotten an attitude because of it, feeling jealous, apparently, that he'd brought a woman home, even though he'd also brought Omar with him as well. But for whatever reason, she calms down, and the four of them ended up hanging out together in the breakfast room. They'd been there together about 20 minutes, maybe, when the doorbell rang. It was Mello and two friends of his. Only this time, talking to Detective Hughes, she knows the names of the friends as well. The first, she says, is JR, and the second is Stink.
According to Detective Hughes' notes, the arrival of three men isn't initially cause for alarm for anybody in the row house. When Omar had come over to the house, he'd asked Bernard to get some cocaine, Starr says, so she seems to imply that Mello's arrival had been expected. He was there to deliver drugs, just like Omar had asked. So when the doorbell rings, nobody's alarmed, and Bernard goes to the front door to let them in. Starr is still in the back of the house, not with Bernard, and the new arrivals are in the front living room. But one of the three men, she IDs him as Stink, walks back to the kitchen and looks at her, Denise, and Omar before walking back to the front living room where Bernard is. From where she is in the kitchen, she hears Bernard say, "Mello, do you have anything?" She knows that what Bernard is really asking is about crack cocaine. Mello has other ideas, though. He asks Bernard, "Where's his money?" telling him he needs to pay up. Bernard owes Mello some kind of debt. Now, according to Starr, it's only $15, but Mello was charging him interest, and he couldn't pay. He doesn't have the money. But Bernard tries to calm Mello down and asks him not to be talking about that in front of his guests. And that's when things take a dark turn. Starr is kind of vague on how it happens, but at this point, the three men and Bernard must have come back to the kitchen area to join Starr, Denise, and Omar, because according to Starr, that's where all the action happens from this point on until it's over. It must have been a cramped encounter. The room is only 8 feet 9 inches wide and 11 feet long, and there's a refrigerator, a table with chairs around it, cabinets with glass shelving, and 7 people crammed into it. So they're all standing around, and then Stink pulls out a sawed-off shotgun and fires it into the ceiling. The third man, the one she calls JR, starts going through everyone's pockets and collecting their money. There's also some money put out on the table. Before Mello and Stink and JR arrived at the house, Omer had pulled out $20 and thrown it on the kitchen table, apparently to pay for the cocaine. But Star notices it before the three men do, or at least she thinks she does, and she grabs it and tries to hide it. No luck. JR sees it, orders her to give the money back, and she does. And that's pretty much it. After turning everyone's pockets inside out, JR and Stink head for the door. Not Mello, though. Mello asks Bernard again, "When are you going to give me that money?" "Tomorrow," Bernard says. That's not good enough for Mello. Mello wants to know what time he's getting the money, and Bernard says, "Before noon." That seems to satisfy Mello, and he turns to walk away. Star relaxes, thinking it's all over, that the incident has passed and everyone is going to go their separate ways. And then Mello, who has made it as if he's about to leave and head back out the door that he came in, turns around again. He pulls out a handgun, a Tech 9, Star thinks, and fires it into Bernard's stomach. Mello and JR and Stink run out of the house and into a gold car, maybe a Monte Carlo, while Bernard collapses onto the floor, shaking violently. There isn't a phone in the row house, so Star thinks quick. She tells Omar to stay with Bernard to remain there with him while she runs to the house where someone Bernard knew once had lived. Bernard's friend passed away, but there's a new tenant now, and he lets Star use the phone to call 911. When Star gets back to the house to meet the police and ambulance, she finds that Omar and Denise have already fled. They didn't stay with Bernard. Most likely, they hadn't wanted to be around when the police got there. And when the police do arrive, just a few minutes after it all happened, Bernard is already dead.
Let's say you're a detective with the Philadelphia Police Department and you've been assigned this case. What would you do? What steps would you take? From a police perspective, your task is pretty straightforward. Locate and arrest the three men Star named. Only one of them had pulled the trigger and shot Julian Bernard Howard, but under the law, all three were equally guilty of this murder. Case almost closed. But you can't get a warrant for a Mello or a Stink or a JR. Who are they, really? What are their legal names? There's not much more that Star can tell you, or at least there's not much more that Star told Detective Hughes that night down at Homicide. They're just some young guys that Bernard knew. They'd come to the house and wanted to sell drugs from there. She says one night they sold cocaine from the front porch. She doesn't know where any of them live, but one time Bernard told her that Mello lived on Cedar Avenue, which was 12 blocks to the south. So maybe that's a place you can start your search.
But that part about Mello living on Cedar Avenue that she tells Detective Hughes down at Homicide? Well, that's already a change in her story. A few hours before that, back on the row house on Sansom, she'd told Officer Medella, one of the first three officers on the scene, that Mello had lived at 6100 block of Walnut, just a block away from that house. Maybe Officer Medella misheard her, or maybe Detective Hughes misheard her. Neither seems to realize that there's a discrepancy here, though, because they don't ever ask her to clarify what she meant or what she said, or where Mello really lives. So, maybe your search for Mello has to start at both Cedar Avenue and on Walnut.
The rest of the description Star gives do provide some physical details about the killers that may be helpful later, though they don't do much to narrow down your pool of suspects. All three of the men had the same outfit and the same haircut, she says. They're wearing white t-shirts and jeans, and they have closely shaved heads. Bald-headed, she calls it. Mello is about 20. He's the darkest skinned of the three, and he has a silver ring and silver necklace with matching crescent emblems. He's short, maybe 5'5" or 5'6". Stink, meanwhile, is the tallest of the three, maybe 5'7" or 5'8", medium build, light skinned, 18 years old. She doesn't recall any other details. And JR, the third young man, is 19, must be very short, she says, about 5'3" with a thin build. So Star is able to give some details at least about the killers, but it's not the kind of detail that will help you too much with finding them or narrowing down the pool of possibilities into any sort of manageable set. The only other clue she can offer is Mello's car. He drives a tannish gold car. Doesn't know the make, but earlier in the evening she described it as a Monte Carlo. And she says the plates are in the car's back window. But that's it. Not much to go on. Though at the very end of her interview with Detective Hughes that night, Star remembers one more thing that may be important. When Mello had come over at 11 p.m. and shot Bernard, that wasn't the first time she'd seen Mello that day. In fact, he'd been over to the house earlier in the day looking for Bernard, but Bernard hadn't been home. So Mello settled for taking their color TV. He picked it up, took it out to his car, put it in the trunk of that brownish gold, maybe Monte Carlo, and drives away. Star told Bernard about what had happened when he came home later, and Bernard told her not to worry about it, he'd take care of it, he said. He hadn't seemed that alarmed by it, or at least Detective Hughes' notes don't suggest that Star told him it was that big of a deal.
So again, you're the officer investigating this case. Where do you go from here, since that's all you can get from Star? Well, the crime scene is a good place to start. And the police do that here. Shortly after Star is taken down to the station, the scene is processed, and for about 2 hours, they go through it, take pictures, make diagrams, and look for evidence. Let's start with forensics. Maybe you'll get lucky and find the old classic here, fingerprint evidence. After all, Star does say that none of the three men had on gloves. And the police do look for fingerprints, kinda. Or at least Officer Sampson, the crime scene unit technician who arrives on the scene, does check for fingerprints on the table in the breakfast room. There aren't any. So that's a dead end. At trial, one of the defense attorneys tries to cross him on this to sort of press him on why he didn't check elsewhere, or check, say, the metal storm door that the defendants would have had to come through to get in. And he doesn't really explain why he didn't, though it does seem as if it might have been a waste of time to check, given all the people who'd come in and out of the door since the murder happened. Either way, no luck there. And then there's ballistics evidence. The first officer in the scene who's assigned the duty of collecting evidence doesn't find anything, but a second officer, Officer Sampson, once he arrives at the scene, takes over, and he's able to find two items. The first is a cartridge casing. And the second is a projectile, the bullet, the part that you actually shoot. And from this, you get some more information, a little bit anyway. Both the casing and the projectile are later determined to have come from a 9mm, and both are consistent with the Tech 9, which is the kind of weapon Star thought that Mello had that night. But that's as far as the ballistics alone is going to get you, because without a weapon to try and match it to, all this really does is help you validate part of Star's story and maybe gives you an idea of what to look for. But there's another fact that might be useful to know, and that's where the casing and the projectile were found. Things get confusing here because we've actually got two different accounts of where those items were collected.
It could be that this information is recorded somewhere, someplace we haven't gotten access to yet. There were photos taken of the crime scene and diagrams were drawn, but we don't have copies. So everything we know about the crime scene is pieced together from officer testimony and their statements. But this makes things confusing because none of the witnesses seem to be using the same terms to describe the same rooms. What we do know is the lower level of the row house had four rooms, all of them laid out in a line, one opening into another. Everyone refers to the first room as the living room. Its doorway opens into a second room, which usually is referred to as the dining room, which opens into room number three. This is the room Star calls the breakfast room. That's where Star, Denise, Omar, and Bernard were before the three men came to the door, and that's where everyone is gathered when the four of them are robbed and Bernard gets shot. And room number four, the last room, is the kitchen. And the reason all this matters is because eventually, in the course of your investigation, it will become clear to you, if it hasn't already, that there may be some problems with Star's story, even aside from the shotgun fired into the ceiling that didn't leave a mark. So where Star claims the shooting happened, and where Bernard was when it happened, and where she was when it happened, yeah, that all could matter. But the confusion over what room is what doesn't help with sorting any of this out. Like, take out this portion of the trial transcript from when Officer Sampson, who processed the crime scene, is cross-examined by one of the defense attorneys.
Question, so walking through the dining room into the breakfast room, that's the doorway that you described as being 2 feet by something?
Answer, 2 feet, 5 inches.
Question, okay, and Mr. Howard's body, part of his body was in that doorway, correct?
Answer, no, it was, yes. It was between the breakfast room and the dining room, correct?
Question, correct. It was between the breakfast room and the kitchen? Question, so you had to walk all the way through the breakfast room?
Answer, that's correct.
That's the way the transcript reads. I'm not sure what happened here, so if the reporter forgot to record a line or switched up which was a question and which was an answer, it's hard to tell. So, was Bernard's body found between rooms 2 and 3, or rooms 3 and 4? The best we can tell, at least from piecing together the statements of the other officers in the scene, it's the latter. Bernard's body was laid out, face up, between rooms 3 and 4. And according to one officer, Bernard's head was pointing into the kitchen, room number 4, with his feet in room number 3, the breakfast room.
So where were the cartridge casing and bullet found in relation to Bernard? Well, that depends what you're going by. At trial, Officer Sampson, the crime scene specialist, testifies that the casing came from the floor of the breakfast room toward the center of the room. That would be the room where Starr says everyone was when the shooting happened. But Detective Hughes' report says it came from the kitchen. It's the room in the very back of the house. And then there's the bullet itself. Officer Sampson testifies he found it on a glass shelf in the breakfast room about 2 feet above the floor. The bullet must have gone through Bernard and landed on the shelf, wherever that shelf was in the room. But then Detective Hughes' report doesn't even mention a bullet being found. He says instead that a bullet hole was found in the mirror in the breakfast room, hanging on the wall between room 3 and room 2. None of which makes it really easy to draw any conclusions about how exactly Bernard was shot or where the shooter was when it happened. The bullet hole in the mirror suggests the shooter had to fire toward the door, that Bernard was between the shooter and the front door. But Starr says Mello shot Bernard as he was leaving, so as he was heading out of room 3 to room 2, going out that door. But then Mello turned around again and shot Bernard in the stomach, the exact opposite of what the bullet hole in the mirror would suggest. So what really happened? Maybe it doesn't matter. It was close quarters after all, so the exact angle at the moment the gun was fired might be meaningless in the scheme of things. In this case, at any rate, no one seems to have decided it was worth spending any time to sort all this out. And that's it for your forensic evidence, which means it would be really nice to have some other witnesses you could use. People other than Starr who might have seen something. And we know for sure there are at least two, Omar and Denise. Starr knows the neighborhoods where she's seen them hanging out, and she tells you cross streets of where they might hang out, but she doesn't know anything further. Not their last name, not where they currently live. But she may know houses where their family members reside, so that's something to look into at least. And the police do follow up on that, though neither Omar nor Denise will make an appearance at trial.
But what about witnesses who may have been outside of the row house? It was a hot, muggy night, and it's not unreasonable to think that people might have been sitting out on their porches trying to catch a breeze when everything went down. The row houses are narrow, close together, and there's easily a dozen houses around the row house where Bernard and Starr lived, where someone that was out on the front porch might have seen something important, might have seen someone coming or going, might have seen who the killer was. Or at least they might be able to give another physical description of the three men that were at the house that night. Apparently, though, everyone on Sansom Street was home in their beds at this time because the police don't find anyone in the neighborhood who saw anything. They do talk to one neighbor who says she heard a loud bang, a gunshot presumably, at about 11:05 p.m., but the police don't find or at least don't talk to anyone else who saw or heard any of the events leading up to Bernard's death. Alright then, so you don't have any other direct witnesses to go off of, but maybe there are people who weren't there at the time of the murder, but might know something about the people involved? And the police do try that too. They check with one of Bernard's friends, a man named John Parsons, but he doesn't seem to know that much, or at least he only gets a brief blurb in the police file. John Parsons tells them that the men who've been selling drugs out of Bernard's house have also sold drugs before at 60th and Chestnut Street. So that's something else to maybe go on. And there is a note that says there could be a detective from the DA's unit, and gives a name, who might have info on the male selling drugs at 60th and Chestnut. Detective Hughes has a note saying he's going to try and follow up with him. But either Hughes never does follow up with that detective, or he does and gets nowhere with it, because it's not referenced ever again. Then again, 60th and Chestnut isn't the only place these guys were supposedly selling drugs. They were apparently also involved in selling drugs from the victim's house. And maybe there's a chance that they were arrested there at some point. Worth checking out anyway. And it seems like the police did do that. Or perhaps they just searched for records for Lena Laws, that is Starr. Either way, they found one. The prior year, in 1995, Starr had been arrested at the Sansom residence after she'd gotten into a fight with another woman. According to the report, Starr had pulled a revolver out and pointed at the woman, although the woman had knocked it out of her hand, at which point Starr ran down the hall and grabbed a shotgun and pointed it at the woman. Again, there was a struggle, and the woman got the shotgun away from her, and Starr ran out of the house, where she was quickly arrested. It turned out that the revolver was actually a starter pistol and the shotgun wasn't loaded. And that was it in the police file. There were no records of any drug arrests, so that's a dead end too. By this point, though, you're running low on leads to follow. There are a few more possible leads, though, that you might want to check out.
Actually, one of these leads seems like it should be one of the first things you follow up on. And that's the beeper number Starr gave the first officers to arrive on the scene, writing down the number 319-1182 and the name Mello on a sheet of paper. You've got that number still. There's a property receipt for it, showing it was put into evidence. At the very least, it seems like it'd be worth giving the number a call. According to Starr, there's a voicemail message that plays when you call, and the person gives her first name. It's not clear if the name is Jamal or Jamar. Different officers at the scene heard her say different things. But either way, maybe you should give the number a call yourself, record the voicemail on the other end, and see if it gives you at least a first name to go off of. Or better yet, maybe subpoena the service provider and see if someone registered the beeper number under their name. But the police don't do that for some reason. Or, if they ever did, they didn't include anything about it in the case file. That beeper number and the connection that it could provide to Mello is checked into evidence and then, apparently, forgotten. Now, from the leads so far, it seems like this case may be harder to solve than it initially appeared. Yes, you have a witness who saw the shooting and who says she could ID all three of the men if she saw them again. But without a way to find those three men again, the case isn't going anywhere.
This case didn't go cold, though. Somehow, the police will ultimately solve it, or at least they'll find three men who'll be charged and convicted of the crime. But what we still don't know is how they solved it. We know it wasn't from any of the leads we just discussed. Those were all dead ends. All we know is that 8 months after Bernard's murder, the Philadelphia Police Department would interview Starr once again. And this time, they'll have a photo array with them. Photographs of eight young men, or boys, really. All of them from student IDs from Overbrook High School. One of the photos is of 17-year-old Terrence Lewis. He's been included in this photo array on purpose. It's his photo they're hoping the Starr will pick out. And she does. "That stinks," she says, pointing at Terrence Lewis. "I am absolutely sure." In the months following this, they will bring Starr in for many more interviews and show her more photos, more lineups, and eventually she'll pick out two other young men who will become Terrence Lewis's co-defendants. The only evidence against any of them will be Starr's identification of them at trial. But in the police and prosecution files that were made available to Terrence's attorneys, there was nothing that could shed light on how Terrence or either of his co-defendants ever came to the police attention. Something had to have made the police include their photos in the lineups. But whatever it was something they weren't interested in letting the defense attorneys know about. And from a defense perspective, that made the case a hard one to investigate. There was nothing to look into, really, nothing to push back on, except for Starr and her insistence that the three defendants were the men who'd killed Bernard.
There's one more piece of evidence that Officer Sampson collected at the scene that's relevant, though not for what it may tell you but the people who killed Bernard, and that's a 7.5-inch length of broken antenna. Officer Sampson collected it from the crime scene and apparently determined it came from a radio or some kind of electronic equipment. He testified at trial that he sent it off to the lab to be tested for the presence of blood, for some reason, which we found confusing at first. Why would you care if there was any blood on this broken antenna? The forensic report shows that wasn't why it was tested, though. Instead, the lab results showed the antenna was tested for lead residue and came back negative. But it might be that what they really were testing for was a presence of cocaine, because antennas can be used as a sort of a DIY crack pipe when necessary. But why not mention this at trial? And why not reference this in any of the police reports? Well, there's at least one more fact about the state Starr eyewitness that's relevant here. At trial, though, the rest of the story did come out. According to Starr, she was addicted to cocaine and smoking crack every day for the past 3 years. Starr testified that she typically smoked at least $25 worth of crack a day, but she claimed that she only had $5 worth of crack to smoke on August 6th. And about 10:30 p.m. that night, just before Bernard arrived home and brought Denise and Omar along with him, Starr had smoked it. And then after Bernard had arrived back, the four of them had wanted more cocaine and were waiting on the men to arrive.
Yeah, I mean, this is really one of the most frustrating things for me in this case, and that is we had these three defendants in the case. They each had their own attorneys, and yet none of them really pushed Starr on her crack use or called an expert witness in the subject. And that's important because, according to Starr, because of her habitual drug use, namely smoking $25 worth of crack cocaine on a daily basis for 3 years, her smoking of crack cocaine on the night of the murder didn't have much of an effect on her observations. And so as a result, I decided I would do my own research. I called a doctor, Dr. Eric Gardner. He's an expert in neurology and neuropsychopharmacology, and he had this to say about the possible effects of smoking crack soon before seeing an event like a shooting.
Cocaine, like most other addictive drugs, has a signature biochemical effect in the brain, which is to say that it elevates, quite dramatically elevates, levels of the neurotransmitter dopamine in the reward and pleasure circuits of the brain. The activation of those circuits is why people take addictive drugs to get high. And so when someone smokes crack cocaine, there is not a 100% probability, but it's quite a high probability that they may experience aberrant perceptions, and that could include hearing voices, although that's not terribly common with cocaine. It could include seeing things that weren't there or not seeing things that are there, and other sensory and perceptual misperceptions.
So this is a technical explanation of what most of us might be inclined to think about the effects on perception of recent crack cocaine use. But the other part might not be as easy to grasp. Here's an excerpt from the opinion of the Supreme Court of Connecticut in State versus Barletta, in which Dr. Gardner testified as an expert witness. Quote, specifically, he explained that there was a high degree of probability that hallucinations may occur after a person has ingested between 1/4 and 1/2 gram of street-quality cocaine, that published studies indicate that between 40 and 50% of cocaine users experience hallucinations, and that those persons with a history of cocaine abuse are more likely to experience hallucinations than less frequent users. And Dr. Gardner told me something similar when I told him the witness in this case had a history of crack cocaine use on a daily basis for 3 years.
People who use cocaine for prolonged periods of time usually have significant aberrations in brain function, significant aberrations specifically, as you phrase it, aberrations in perception, hallucinatory aberrations in perception. As a matter of fact, one of the definitions of psychosis is that people have hallucinations. They can be visual hallucinations, they can be auditory hallucinations, they can be somatosensory hallucinations, they can even be olfactory hallucinations. Even short-term use of cocaine can do that. There's fairly good evidence that the longer the use, the more likely there is to be these aberrations in brain function.
So yeah, there's every reason to believe that Starr's description of the shooting and her identification of the shooters was unreliable based upon both persistent and recent crack cocaine use.
In the prosecutor's opening arguments, he told the jury that this was a virtually perfect case. A witness with no reason to lie and whose only motivation was to see justice done for a loved one. And maybe the prosecutor was right, that Starr didn't have a reason to lie. But just because she wasn't lying doesn't mean she was telling the truth. And in this case, we already know that there was something wrong with Starr's story. That some of what she said couldn't have actually happened. And it's hard to understand how or why she might have made the mistakes she did. Like with the shotgun. The one that Stink, aka Terrence Lewis, fired into the ceiling just before Starr and the others in the row house were robbed. But there was no hole left in the ceiling, and there was no shotgun shell left in the floor. There's no reason at all to think a shotgun was fired that night. It just didn't happen. That whole sequence of events that Starr described, where did it come from? It doesn't seem like she's lying, exactly, because, well, why would she lie about that? What reason would she have to do so? But it's also not true. And it's not the only part of Starr's story that can't be true. On the night of Bernard's murder, Starr told the cops that were at the house and then told the detective down at the homicide unit about watching Mello move as if to leave, to head back towards the front door, when suddenly he stopped, turned around again, and then shot Bernard in the stomach. The police had no reason to question her at the time on this. They'd seen the gunshot wound for themselves. Only, when the police got the autopsy report back, there was a problem. It read, "Cause of death, shotgun wound to the back." Yeah, Bernard was killed by a close contact shot from a gun pressed into the small of his back, angled upwards. They found the muzzle abrasion, so they know the gun was touching his back when it was fired. The gunshot wound that the police had seen on his stomach, that was an exit wound, not an entrance wound. So Starr was wrong about how Bernard was shot, just like she was wrong about the shotgun being fired into the ceiling. And it was her word, and her word alone, uncorroborated by any other evidence, that made the virtually perfect case against Terrence Lewis and sent a 17-year-old to prison for life.
Thank you to Mital Dulhan as our executive producer. Thanks for keeping us going. Baluki, thank you so much for designing our logo. A big thanks to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. Thank you to all of our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Thanks so much to Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production. And Rebecca, by the way, is also host of the podcast Crime Writers On and one of my favorite, HGTV and Me. Definitely check it out. Don't forget to send any questions you have to us over Twitter and use the hashtag UDAddendum. And don't forget to follow us online on all our social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.